This podcast examines issues on violence driven by gender inequality, a global health problem that is likely to have personally touched the lives of our listeners. Please do take care while listening and email us at sri@svri.org for resources.
Welcome to another episode of the Sexual Violence Research Podcast from the SVRI. I'm Aisha Margot.
And I am Elizabeth Dartnell. Our vision is to see a world free of violence against women and violence against children. And in this podcast, we learn how to make that vision a reality.
In today's episode, we're discussing the often overlooked role of climate change in exacerbating violence against women.
It's no secret that our planet is facing huge threats due to the impacts of climate change, with the number of climate-related disasters tripling in the last 30 years. Though entire populations are affected, women and girls suffer the most. The UN Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women and Girls described climate change as a threat multiplier in terms of gendered inequalities.
To discuss this and the role governments and organizations should be playing in countering this threat to women, we're joined by Amy Noel Mbiozo, a senior research consultant at the Institute for Security Studies in Pretoria, South Africa, and Jean Ward, an internationally recognized expert on violence against women and protection against sexual exploitation and abuse.
Research suggests that women and girls are up to 14 times more likely to be harmed during a natural disaster. So why is it that violence against women is so exacerbated by climate change? Here's Jean to explain.
In terms of gender-based violence, climate change creates these chronic and acute stressors which can exacerbate or amplify pre-existing GBV risks for women and girls, such as poverty, these rigid gender roles, and personal and community conflict. We have to remember that it's the social construction of gender rather than specific biological differences that determine women and girls' vulnerabilities. In acute disasters such as flooding and cyclones and wildfires, the additional workload for women and girls might mean they're not able to be as responsive to the domestic demands of male family members, which in turn increases household tensions that result in violence. Or women and girls might be required to walk increasingly longer distances to find potable water and food for their families, making them vulnerable to sexual assault. And in these types of acute disasters, there's often displacement, and that displacement can itself increase the risk of exposure to GBV, say in transit centers or in refugee camps. Displaced women might lack access to food or the ability to feed their family, leading to increased risk for sexual exploitation through transactional sex or through child marriage. In one example, after a cyclone struck Bangladesh in 2007, criminal networks forced women and girls into prostitution along the Indian border. Child marriage has also increased after the cyclone as a means of reducing families' financial burdens. And interestingly, and important for all of us who are working in the humanitarian space, poorly designed relief efforts can compound the risks of GBV. A study of the humanitarian response effort in Samoa following a cyclone in 2012 found that the unequal distribution of supplies created community tension, indirectly leading to a rise in intimate partner violence.
Amy Noel adds that the impacts of humanitarian emergencies are so often gendered because events such as natural disasters expose underlying discrimination within society.
I think when it comes to any humanitarian emergencies that are linked to climate, what you generally see is that the climate, whether it's sudden onset or slow onset disasters, really do an unveiling of the underlying discrimination and unequal accesses to any resources. And when it comes to climate disasters, unfortunately, women have a much higher rate of death in disasters, and that has a lot to do with the responsibilities that they have and to their access to services post-disaster. But generally speaking, what climate emergencies, the impact that they have on gender is that they really expose all of that underlying discrimination.
We have just heard Amy Noel refer to slow and sudden onset impacts. Sudden onset hazards are those which might occur in the immediate aftermath of a natural disaster, whereas slow onset impacts are consequences we might see months or years down the line. Amy Noel says when it comes to climate change, we're already seeing the effects of sudden onset impacts disproportionately affecting women.
So when it comes to displacement, something like a hurricane, a cyclone, or a massive, you know, flood, it's a lot easier to track how people move according to that disaster. So they're much more likely to leave and to leave together and to leave to the closest possible place where they can find some aid. And then they're more likely to return. Whereas slow onset impacts are happening, and they're happening now, that we're talking about droughts or salinization or sea level rise that are changing, you know, access to fish or agriculture, et cetera. And in Africa, I think, let me say that those impacts are definitely already happening, but they're just a lot harder to track how people move and how they disproportionately impact women and their onward trajectories. But I think it's really important to note that in sub-Saharan Africa, women are responsible for 80% of food production, and that of the women employed on the continent, 60% of them are employed in some form of agriculture or along the agricultural value chain. Two-thirds of agriculture on the continent is rain-fed. So as those impacts, as the slow onset climate impacts increasingly affect agricultural and production, they are in and of themselves are disproportionately impacting women. And despite making up such a huge part of the workforce and to food production, they have, due to gender roles and access, they have far less access to the resilience measures that are needed. So that comes to education. Land tenure is a big one. So women have considerably less access to land tenure, which is then needed to get credit to then, you know, invest in things that are going to resilience measures that are going to help defend against the impacts of climate change. So yeah, women have less access to the land tenure, to ownership of business or other productive assets, or to social protections and technologies and education. So that puts them in a position, yeah, that diminishes their ability to adapt to these onset changes.
Jean explains that natural disasters caused by climate change can result in several types of violence against women becoming more prevalent.
Many of the risks to gender-based violence are actually similar for slow onset climate events and acute events. But interestingly, for slow onset events exacerbated by climate change, such as drought, for example, evidence suggests that communities under stress may adapt more conservative or customary patriarchal practices. And this in turn can increase the GBV risk for women and girls. Extreme stress, poverty and communal loss, the scarcity of food that Ami talked about and water may contribute to community conflict over resources and increased incidents of violence by men, including gender-based violence. In the Sahel, where there is a drought, women and girls are required to walk increasingly longer distances to find water and food for their families, making them vulnerable to sexual assault. And in the context of resource scarcity, women and girls are more likely to be coerced into sexual exploitation. 5 out of 8 participants in a study in Namibia noted that transactional sex had occurred in their communities because drought made food insufficient and women needed to provide for their families. And when families are unable to meet their basic needs, evidence suggests that the risk of child marriage also increases significantly for girls.
And she adds, there are several additional considerations when it comes to specific, historically marginalized groups.
As with any type of GBV intervention, it's important for us to do an intersectional analysis to understand the various levels of intersecting oppression that different women and girls might experience in order to shape our response. We already mentioned the issue, for example, of child marriage affecting young girls. We also know that women and girls marginalized as a result of other issues, such as their ethnicity, for example, often have less access to information about climate events and less skills to mitigate the risk of climate events. And this is true in both slow onset and sudden onset disasters. So we need to be more aware of the particular needs of different groups of women and girls and try and integrate their leadership and their participation into our planning mechanisms as early as possible.
And both Amy Noel and Jean highlight that women in some regions of the world are more impacted by climate change than others.
I think it goes without saying, and this is the cornerstone of the Paris Agreement, is that wealthy countries have really created the problem that the poorest people in the poorest countries are going to be bearing the brunt of and are already bearing the brunt of. So you can see across Africa right now, there's many examples of this. I just came off of a session that was looking at the drought in Somalia, and across the Horn, they're on their sixth consecutive dry season. It's the worst drought in 40 years. And they're talking about people who are internally displaced within Somalia, overwhelmingly women with children who are leaving their homes to get aid. So they're not being displaced by the drought, or they're not being displaced by conflict. They're moving because they're out of food and water effectively. So they're moving to places that have aid. And that's a pretty staggering fact, and has a huge impact on women and on families. So there's many examples across the continent right now of places that are really, really struggling with climate impacts. And within each of those situations, you're going to see that women are bearing a disproportionate burden.
Based on the acceleration of disasters intensity globally, the IFRC projects that around 150 million people annually will need humanitarian assistance related to climate events by 2030. Compared to about 100 million now. In terms of the folks who are most affected or the communities that are most affected, we know that countries in the global south are generally more exposed to climate change related hazards. And the truth of the matter is that countries, as Amy Noel's already said, countries that are better able to adapt to climate change are going to suffer less. High-income countries experienced more disasters overall from 2004 to 2013, and yet they experienced less mortality related to disasters. Researchers estimate that more than three times as many people died per disaster in low-income countries compared to high-income countries during that time period. A really important and sobering statistic.
Let's turn now to consider some of the challenges that we face when it comes to researching climate change and violence against women. Amy Noel says a lack of funding is one of the key issues.
I think what we need to remember when it comes to climate action is that, as we've already established, that women bear the brunt of the climate impacts. And so that puts them in a position where they're really at the forefront of developing effective adaptation strategies. So they're contributing different capabilities and responses that men are contributing. And that evidence around that is already quite clear. So they play a different role and an important role in community resilience. They tend to extend their networks and resources to larger groups to benefit from than men do. And they've really emerged as leaders in developing innovative solutions to things already. So, you know, they've come up with drought-resistant seeds or better soil management, or they're leading reforestation efforts. And they're doing a good job in multiple situations at, you know, engaging a deeper reach into the communities. So there's really a growing recognition that gender equality and that gender responsive funding are really important for any really sustainable climate action. And you have seen an increase in gender responsive climate financing that targets these gender inequalities, specifically in Africa. So it's increased from an average of $80 million per year in 2010 to $1.6 billion in 2019. But despite all of this increase, more than three quarters of all the climate development financing that's being targeted towards Africa still fails to consider any gender. So we're putting out a strong call, to see more women in decision-making bodies when it comes to climate action and to really increase how much funding is targeting gender responsiveness and gender inequality, because that's going to make a big difference in the quality of the actual rollout. So yeah, we're looking for more women-led initiatives, more women on decision-making bodies, and more higher quality and quantity of funding that's going towards gender equality.
So do current frameworks within the humanitarian system support the prevention and response efforts of violence against women? Jean says that the global spotlight on climate change provides a unique opportunity for more frameworks to be developed.
Ami Noel alluded to the fact that the work on climate change is proliferating around the world. This is just a simple recognition about the profound impact climate change is going to have on the world in the very near future. And already, this accelerated attention to climate change represents an exciting opportunity for GBV actors working in humanitarian crises, as well as at the nexus of humanitarian and development programming, to ensure better attention to GBV and gender equality in both acute and slow onset climate-related disasters. And there's already recognition of the need to incorporate attention to GBV and disaster risk reduction and preparedness planning and contingency planning and response. However, these efforts to link GBV and climate change have been relatively limited, including in humanitarian response. In terms of specific frameworks, there are a number of existing frameworks that can integrate better attention to GBV. Some of these are disaster risk reduction, preparedness and contingency planning, climate change adaptation, work on climate change adaptation, work on resilience, and then very excitingly, work on anticipatory action, which is a very specific kind of new intervention in the humanitarian space to try and take action to reduce or mitigate the impact of disasters and facilitate better post-disaster response using forecasts or early warnings of imminent shock or stress. So that's anticipatory action is itself a very exciting opportunity or framework for doing more work on climate change and integrating attention to GBV within that work.
She adds that it's vital governments and humanitarian organizations adapt their response to climate change to include the impacts of violence against women.
If gender inequality and its links to climate change and gender-based violence and its links to climate change are not adequately addressed, then the impact of climate change is not going to be sufficiently managed. It's really important for humanitarian actors to have a keener sense of an ability to respond to and prevent the links between climate change and gender-based violence in order to improve the sustainability of their interventions, the impact of their interventions. And it's very critical that the GBV community engage governments around this discussion, including especially ministries that are working on gender equality and women's affairs, really bringing them into the climate change conversation as an opportunity for them to have more voice around this important work that's accelerating globally.
And Ami Noel says migration can provide valuable opportunities for women impacted by climate change.
You know, migration is often framed, particularly in, you know, South Africa, as a risk to a country. So it's often framed as something that's negative that needs to be sort of contained or prevented. But in reality, it can be a really effective adaptation measure, and in particularly for women. So it's something that has been clearly established to empower women. Women typically move from areas of higher restriction and more violence towards areas that are more progressive and empowering for them, where they have more freedom. So they tend to move from one to the other. And in that context, it can really increase autonomy and mastery. People have more accesses to work and new skills and send remittances, and they can change their social standing, and they can help disrupt gender norms and inequality. And it's important to note that in Africa, more women are moving, and more women are moving independently. The number of female international migrants on the continent has increased from 6.2 million in 1990 to 10.5 million in 2020. So that reflects a real movement among women. It has been established that they remit differently and they remit more, and that they do different things once they've received remittances. So it is a really important piece of gender empowerment, and it's something that we need to really change the narrative on. We also need more gender data when it comes to mobility. We tend to view it, when we talk about it, particularly in South Africa, we talk about it as if it's all sort of being done by independent men who are moving, who are sort of low or unskilled and are coming to steal jobs and make crime. And that's not what's happening at all. It's important that we're empowering voluntary mobility among women and protecting them along those pathways as well.
So we've heard some of the challenges when it comes to researching the effects of climate change on women, and we've considered what governments and humanitarian organisations need to be doing better to support women impacted by climate change. But are there any systems already in place that have shown to work? Both Amy Noel and Jean say there are certainly some great examples which can be pulled from.
There are a number of examples of where, you know, women have been supported to develop and implement, to design, develop, implement things like water projects or to guide remittances, where they've had really good outcomes on a relatively small case study and pilot study scale. So there are a number of inspiring stories of where women have, you know, upskilled themselves for not just climate resilience, but for new skills, you know, education for family. It's been proven many, many times over that a woman is going to do something different with their dollar than a man will, and that it's going to be more family focused and more long-term focused. And that's playing itself out in the climate space as well. So in areas where women have, where men have, let's say, migrated to find into cities to find work, whether it's temporary or circular or longer term, the women who have been left behind, and this is a case study out of Somalia, have taken longer term trajectories on resilience strategies. So they're looking further down the line and they're implementing longer term solutions around drought resistant seed or new farming practices or different crops that are projected to do better in drought conditions. So there are a lot of inspiring stories and case studies that do involve women, but they, at this point, they haven't been enabled to be scaled up. And that's going to, again, require more women represented on decision-making bodies and more women at the forefront of developing these solutions and with broader support.
I think the scale up that Amy Noel is mentioning is really key. There are many, many examples of specific interventions that are happening around the world. There's great work that's happened in disasters in Indonesia to integrate attention to GBV in government policies and preparedness plans. There's work going on in the Sahel to promote resilience, specifically targeting women and girls related to slow onset climate-induced stressors. There's some interesting work on early warning and forecasting mechanisms happening with GBV partners working in Malawi and Zambia, Mozambique and Kenya, trying to focus specifically on food security and nutrition and the vulnerabilities associated with food security and nutrition that link to GBV. So there's a lot of really important work. It's really about scale up and making sure that the resources for this work are fully integrated into planning processes to address the impacts of climate change.
Finally, how optimistic are each of our guests that governments and humanitarian organizations are listening to the evidence and making sure their policies include frameworks to address violence against women?
I think, unfortunately, what we've learned in the last couple of years with COVID, and again, when it comes to, you know, the impacts on resources of the Ukraine war and what countries are willing to tolerate, basically, if it's their crisis versus someone else's crisis, is I think we've seen that the world will respond differently, whether or not a situation is on their own shores, and that the last couple of years have really, again, highlighted the inequality in our behavior and our responses and our rollout. So that's a little bit of a pessimistic view. But I think within that, you have a lot of organizations and even governments who really are listening and who really do want to make a difference and are doing great work. So I think at the end of the day, the answer to this question probably reflects overall humanity, where some people are going to be the worst of us and probably deepen inequality. And unfortunately, that probably means deepen inequality towards women, deepen violence, including probably violence towards women, whereas other actors are going to be continuing to uptake good policies. Yeah, so there are a lot of people who are really doing good work around protecting women and around advancing gender equality and the rights of women. And it's important to pin our hopes on some of those really good actors. And I think in the context of climate change, the news is often bad, but there is glimmers of hope. And there's also, you know, the looming mandate that we have to. So we just have to keep going.
And I think that this is a real opportunity for the GBV community to ensure that there's better attention to GBV and gender equality and climate action. This means that the GBV community is going to have to build their understanding of the global, regional, and national systems and policies and funding streams related to climate change. And because these systems are often included within and guided by development progress, it means that GBV actors working in humanitarian crises are going to need to link more to development action. But we've talked about this previously, but it's really important that GBV actors build off the capacity of relevant government partners, particularly the ministries related to women's affairs, to understand and get involved in climate change action at the national level. And this includes influencing climate change policies and national action plans and understanding how to access climate change funds to support GBV prevention and response. We're already seeing this happening in pockets of the world, and it's just a really critical time for us to ensure that we're taking this kind of work to scale.
A big thanks to our guests, Amy Noel Mbiyozo and Jean Ward, for joining us on the podcast. I am Elizabeth Dartnell.
And I'm Aisha Margo. You've been listening to the Sexual Violence Research Podcast by the SVRI. To find out more about our vision, visit www.svri.org.
To free the world of violence against women and violence against children, we have to connect, learn, and share. So please subscribe, like, and review us on Apple Podcasts, and share this episode far and wide.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.
This podcast is produced by OG Podcasts. Find out more at ogpodcasts.co.uk.